My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Neuer challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
Here's round one, which tests their vocabularies. And for 2 marks, I want you to give me the meaning of the following words. We begin with Dennis Powell. Dennis, yours is mnemonic.
Mnemonic means something which helps you to remember something. A word or phrase or letters or something which would help you to remember.
Remember what?
Another word or phrase or something.
You're dead right. 2 marks. It's the association of ideas, or it can be verses which are easy to remember and keeps some otherwise totally forgettable object in mind. And it's based on the principles of analogy, usually. And it's a Greek word. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, Parkinson's law.
Well, work expands to occupy the time and the space of those available to do it.
That's, I think, quite good enough. If there was an earlier one, I don't mind which of the Parkinson's. I think there are 3 or 4 or 5 Parkinson laws now. Chap called C. Northcote Parkinson. I think the first one was that the amount of work done is in inverse proportion to the number of people employed. And he was especially referring to public administration. But Dennis is quite right. The second law, I think, work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. It is very handy for most offices. 2 marks.
He's never put a cold, warm baby on a cold slab.
Well, it's Anne Scott James next. Anne, quintessence.
Means the essential nature of a thing.
Yes. Do you remember how it sort of fits into a category?
It sort of fits into a category.
Well, originally.
Well, it must be a Latin word.
Yes.
And it must mean the fifth nature, the fifth being.
Yes.
The fifth element.
That's it. That's what I wanted. 2 marks. Thank you. Gerrymander.
Gerrymander is a German lizard.
You're very much on the right tack.
But it's an American political expression.
Yes.
And it's to do with altering the boundaries of voting districts.
That's right. Yep. Absolutely right. Do you remember who did it?
I should think Gerrymander.
You're near enough to be in.
His wife, Sally.
Well, that's what I want. It comes from the name of Governor Elbridge Gerry, who lived between 1744 and 1814, and Salamander, because of the likeness to that curious animal of the gerrymandered electoral map of Massachusetts in 1811. So you're quite right. You manipulate the electorate in order to give advantage to your own party. Well, at this point, I give Frank and Dennis a quotation to think about for their stories in the last round. And Frank, yours is, Allons au fond de la patrie, eux. And for you, Dennis. And for you, Dennis. The female of the species is more deadly than the male. Well, now we have a round of incomplete quotations. And here are some sage sayings by fairly well-known people, but not finished off. 1 mark for finishing the quotation, and 1 mark for identifying its author. Dennis Powell, beware of all enterprises that require blank.
Money.
Money, not too?
No.
Don't like money. They require intelligence.
Yeah, that's quite a good thing to do, I agree.
Is it an of? Is it beware of all, or just beware of?
Sorry, beware of all enterprises that require.
No, it isn't money or intelligence. It's belief.
No, it was written by a simple lifer.
A simple lifer?
What, sorrow?
Yes.
Ah!
Well done. Now, what do you think Thoreau might have been saying?
Well, he's probably got mouse traps, isn't he?
Living in the woods, far from Hardy Amos, as he was.
Machinery, or...
Stick to the Hardy Amos.
Stick to the...
Hardy Amos.
Clothes?
What kind of clothes?
Smart clothes.
Yes. I helped rather a lot here.
Yeah.
I think 1.5. What Thoreau, living in the woods in Walden or Walden, actually said was, beware of all enterprises that require new clothes.
New clothes?
It's a very, very sound motto.
Absolutely. Thoreau's favourite music was wind through telegraph wires.
Yes.
Which writes him off as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, he became a bit dull in later life. It's Dennis Norden's turn now. The mass of men live lives of...
The actual quotation is, the mass of men live lives of quiet desperation,
right.
But today it's diet desperation.
Author? We've had him already.
Was he also Thoreau?
I don't think I help much there. The mass of men live lives of quiet desperation. It is Thoreau, an essay on economy in the book Walden. Anne Scott James. Cauliflower is nothing but...
an edible rose.
Well, that's probably
nice,
good.
Isn't
yes, it?
Yeah.
It isn't quite the phrase, but that's roughly the idea that is behind the phrase as a whole.
A flower you put manure on.
I wouldn't go on with that.
Would you go on with the floral side?
No, it's a chap who had a job on the Mississippi. I don't know how to help
him. Twain, Mark Twain.
Yes.
Mark Twain.
Cauliflower is nothing but... Now, think of the sort of thing he might have said.
Well, sir.
Cabbage.
Yes, go on.
Cabbage with knobs on.
Well, very nearly, yes. academic knobs on.
Yes.
With a hat on.
Cabbage with pretension.
Yes, that's right, you're getting that. 1.5 again. What Mark Twain actually said was, cauliflower is nothing but cabbage with a college education.
It's very good, very good.
Now, Frank, no. A man cannot have a pure mind who...
goes mixed bathing. Is it that kind?
It's a bit more gastronomic than that.
Oh, is it one of these Sydney Smiths?
No, he probably ate them as a wedding guest.
Luttrell, I felt.
If he wasn't beating his breast.
Coleridge.
Yes. Now, let's think what Coleridge might have finished.
It wasn't
quotation or
boiled
wind.
Albatross, was it?
Well, it's in that order, but not quite so full of protein.
A pie.
It's almost a pie.
Almost a pie.
A man, well, you listen to what I say and you'll agree. It's a very small kind of pie, a rather special one. A man cannot have a pure mind who refuses apple dumplings. That was apparently said by Coleridge, but it's reported in writing by Charles Lamb in an essay of his called Grace Before Meals. 1 out of 2. That gives us, ladies and gentlemen, an interim score in which just ahead, Dennis Norden and Anne Scott James are leading by 1 mark. Now a round of origins and derivations, and this time it's a team effort, which means that they can officially both answer at once on one side. 2 marks, if the teams can tell me how the following words or phrases originated, or were derived. We begin with Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, and your word is juggernaut, or it can be juggernaut. That is either J-U-double-G-E-R-N-A-U-T, or... J-A-double-G-A-N-A-T-H.
Have you finished?
Yeah. Have to do my spelling.
It's an Elizabethan word meaning an empty pitcher.
No marks so far.
You know it's modern corruption, don't you?
Yes, but adding to Frank's admirable solution, it's an Indian word.
Yes.
And it means of those damn great, not a lorry driven by internal combustion, but drawn by people. It's a great big thing dragged along, under which people threw themselves.
Yes, but what was on the car?
Oh, Krishna.
Yes.
It's a huge, great Indian idol.
Yes.
Krishna.
So which was Jagannath?
What? I?
Which was Jagannath?
Well, it was about a 40-wheeled car.
No, that's where you're going wrong. And thanks, very nearly right.
It was the god on it, wasn't it?
Yes, the god. It's not the car. No. It's not the god. It's the Krishna.
Yes, the god on it.
All right, 1.5. This is Hindu god regarded as the remover of sin. That means lord of the world. And at a town called Puri in Orissa, he was on view only 3 days. They watched him the first day, and he got a terrible cold, and for 10 days, nobody was able to look at him at all. And he was then taken, at the end of that, in his enormous decorated car to the temple, and then taken back again, and without a circulation for a year. And the fanatics used, because he was an object of great devotion, every now and then to throw themselves under the wheels of this enormous car and get crushed to death. Now, Anne Scott James and Dennis, it's your turn. Why should a red herring be a fox's friend?
Well, a red herring is a false scent,
yep,
or a false trail, and I suppose a fox, poor hunted creature, would welcome his pursuers going down a false trail.
Yes.
That's in Sweden. They've got, I'm trying to remember what the name of it is, but they have a thing where they bury the herring in the ground for a year. If you did that, it would not only put the hounds off the scent, it would... it would get all the hunt and the anti-blood sports league cantering off in the other direction as well.
It's right. A smoked and salted herring, allegedly, if you draw it across the trail of scent left by a fox, the hounds simply lose the scent and go chasing the red herring as well. Nowadays, I believe they use aniseed, the league against cruel sports, so there aren't any number of red herrings about. 2 marks.
So you have aniseed in a sort of official drag, don't you?
You do as well, yes. But if you do it, drag it across the
trail. But now, why, if this is an old phrase, should it have been done? Because nobody disapproved of fox hunting until relatively recently, did they?
Well, there might have been rival masters of the fox hounds.
You think so, keep the foxes in their
vicinities? Yeah, sure.
Is a hunt ball after drag hounds called a drag ball?
If anything was a red herring, it's that lost rock of Franks. And now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the program. And on this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Frank, your quotation is, "Allons, enfants de la patrie, l'heure de gloire est arrivée," which is the opening line of the Marseillaise. Frank.
I had this nasty experience a year ago in a trouser shop. It was just off the Kensington High Street, and it was a rather modern shop, which I hadn't realised, and when I took the selected trousers in to change them, to try them on, it didn't have a proper closing to the changing room. They had a pair of extremely inadequate sort of cowboy saloon doors, about 18 inches deep. I don't know what the height of a normal trouser trial honour is. But it's not 6'6", which I am. And the vulnerable area was in grave danger. Throughout this thing, I suddenly realised I couldn't... If I wore thick socks, I would have been arrested. It was that. And you realise you have to bob down to take your trousers off and put new ones on? I couldn't... And then the awful thing was that when I was struggling in there, suddenly with mounting horror, I realised that it was a bisexual place. There were women in there, sitting down and looking vaguely in my direction. Eventually I staggered out. I obviously had to have a sit down. I had a come over. The nerves were twanging, and I was lying there with the eyes closed, and a voice said, "You don't look too well. I can place on the hands. I cure things by just placing my hands on them." And then I think to myself, along the Fond de la Patrie, and there's a sudden surge of spirit through my fingertips, and my fingertips tremble, and whoever I'm touching and caressing is cured. He sat down beside me and said, my card. And it said, Alonzo de Quincey. I said, what do you cure? Do you cure people? He said, well, not yet. I haven't actually cured a person. That's why I was hoping I could try with you. My auntie Ethel's glad. I said, well, no doubt she would be. No. He said, glad, her gladioli. Auntie's glad was all wilting. And I looked at it. And on the upper tree, tingle went the fingertips. I stroked it. It was lovely. She could have won a prize, a Chelsea flower show with it. I said, well, thank you for the card, Mr. Alonzo de Quincey. Shall I ever need you? It was about a year ago, you see. And by heavens, only this morning we needed him. We've had a terrible year in... I don't know about you, but this disastrous year in the garden. It started off with a front gate getting Dutch elm disease. Well, it was. The white paint turned yellow and the top bar sort of crumbled away, you know, which is a symptom of Dutch elm disease. It dies from the top. And all the roses alongside the drive suffered from the flu. We got all central heating, and the flu is just by the roses. And the oil sort of dragged and fell down on them. They all sort of died off. And the lawn, very peculiar, happened during the summer with the lawn. It's around about sort of July, when things were usually growing rather fiercely. My wife said, do you realise we haven't cut the lawn for 7 weeks? It's not growing. It's got that new mown look. I said, do you realise what that lawn's suffering from? Pneumonia. And it didn't grow. It just sort of went there and went brown. But the worst blow was our pears. We've got this fantastic old pear tree. And when these are really ripe, I mean, the whole neighbourhood gathers for our pears. But this year, awful mottled leaves. No pears. Little sort of round things with spots. My wife said, it thinks it's a crabapple tree. I said, that pear tree's had a nervous breakdown. Of all things. She said, well, we could never save it now. And I said, yes, there was just a chance in a million. A year ago, I met a man who I think could do this. I've got his card somewhere. Rush upstairs to the suit I wear when I go up to town. I want to turn up some buttons. There is his card, Alonzo de Quincey, Leona of Hands. No address. So, my only hope is that he's listening tonight. So, Mr. de Quincey, if you are listening tonight, please will you react just once more to that stirring call which does so well. Alonzo, fondle our pear tree.
We should be breaking off diplomatic relations tomorrow, but we'll go on to Dennis and his storyline, which, if you remember, was the female of the species is more deadly than the male.
You may have heard, mainly because Frank and I keep on mentioning it, that they've now published a book of these My Word stories. Well, one consequence of that is that over the past few weeks, we've both been rather involved in what they call the promotion of this book. So the publishers decided that they'd send me round the country making speeches at literary luncheons. The theory being that these speeches would so convulse all present with helpless laughter, they'd rush into the foyer and snatch up copies of the book by the armful, you see. And that was a theory. There's only one thing wrong with the theory. And that's the word luncheon. You see, all my life, I've been the victim of what my mother calls a delicate stomach. Any unfamiliar kind of food, and the whole of my internal workings go into a rhythmical kind of side-to-side lurching, like worn-out windscreen wipers. Everything inside, flump, flump, from one side to another. Because I eat indigestion tablets like other people eat grapes. Now, bearing that fact in mind, let me tell you the kind of meal you get at these literary luncheons. Generally, it's a sort of beige-coloured soup, roast chicken, ice cream, coffee, all served at the same temperature. Which is why, after making 18 of these speeches in 12 major cities, the number of books purchased after the meal amounted to no more than one. And that was only because I had nothing to read on the train going back. Well, the publishers, naturally, they got rather sniffy about this. So prior to the luncheon, they booked for me in Cornwall. I sent them a letter apologising. I said, I'm sorry, but if strange foods upset me, what can I do? And by return, I received a three-word telegram. Don't eat it. They're not mugs, these publishers. I thought, that is a good idea. So in that quaint old Cornish town, I pleaded religious grounds and sat through the whole meal without touching a crumb. And, you know, by the time the lady chairman got up to introduce me, I felt marvellous. And she said, ladies, she said, we have a real treat in store today. Someone who in this troubled and darkening world is going to bring us the precious gift of laughter. But before I ask him to set us all rocking with his hilarious quips, I have one official duty to perform. Would you all please rise and stand for one moment's silent tribute to our honorary secretary who died last night in such tragic circumstances? Then, for the longest 60 seconds in recorded history, that whole gathering stood up with heads bowed in a silence that was broken only by the occasional sob. The moment they sat down, Madam Chairman announced, and here he is then, the irrepressible funster, Mr. Dennis Mill. Well, just looking across at that sea of faces, many of them with the tears still trickling down their youth-due blush on, I felt a familiar sensation inside. Windscreen wipers. At this time, even worse than on the occasions when I'd eaten the grub. So when the publishers wrote to me asking me why it was that not only had nobody in Cornwall bought a copy of the book after the meal, but four ladies had asked if they could return there, my reply was terse and to the point. Given the choice, I said, I'd rather partake of the meal than suffer the kind of introduction that this lady had given me. Or, as I actually put it in the telegram, the female of the speeches is more deadly than the meal.
And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the story, and he and Dillis Powell also just win the entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.